Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Welcome back, everyone, to Your Case is on Hold, episode 71. We're entering the holiday season, and we are rounding out our third year doing this, coming up on 72nd episode before the year is over. If you're listening on the day we're dropping, it's December 3rd for the December 4th issue of JBJS. I am Andrew Schoenfeld, Deputy Editor for Methods, Epidural Bone and Joint Surgery, and I have with me, as always,
Antonia Chen, Deputy Editor of Adult Reconstruction.
This episode is brought to you by CME at JBJS. If you're looking for the gift that keeps on giving the whole year long, in all honesty, there's probably nothing better than giving someone, or probably more likely gifting yourself, a subscription to JBJS CME that's going to cover clinical classroom. It's going to cover access to the self-assessment exams, which are really vital for maintenance of certification and web-based longitudinal assessment in these times. It's going to cover access to the subspecialty exams, the quarterly exams. It's really one bundle and you get everything that you need. As per the usual legal disclaimers here, the opinions that you hear are mine and Dr. Chen's and not those of the editorial board, the editor-in-chief, the editors of the constituent journals, or the board of trustees. So we'll see if we're in the spirit of the season and giving everybody green as go this month, or if we're going to be Krampuses and putting cases on hold. So let's find out. Let's get into it. Top of the pile. What's New in Musculoskeletal Basic Science by Gugal and colleagues, permanently free. Shoulder Periprosthetic Joint Infection, Principles of Prevention, Diagnosis, and Treatment by Nizal and colleagues. Then we have What's Important, Michelangelo and the Fighter Pilot, Role Models for Preserving Patient-Focused Care by Lyons. That's permanently free. Artificial Intelligence Portrayals in Orthopedic Surgery, an Analysis of Gender and Racial Diversity Using Text-to-Image Generators by Morcos and colleagues. Academic and Demographic Profile of Orthopedic Vice Chairs of Research, Implications for Leadership by Arbindi. Validation of DASH and Quick DASH for Outcomes Assessment of Anatomic Total Shoulder Arthroplasty for the Treatment of Advanced Glenohumeral Arthritis by Kova Rubius and colleagues. That's 30 days free with also an infographic. Then we have Deep Learning-Based Computer-Aided Diagnosis of Osteochondritis Dissecans of the Humeral Capitellum Using Ultrasound Images by Takatsuji and colleagues. That's also permanently free. Early Sagittal Shape of the Spine Predicts Scoliosis Development in a Syndromic 22q11.2DS Population, a Prospective Longitudinal Study by DeRuiver and colleagues, also permanently free. And then the T4 to L1 Hip Axis, Sagittal Spinal Realignment Targets in Long Construct Adult Spinal Deformity Surgery, Early Impact by Hills and colleagues. I mean, for the holiday season, the editor-in-chief has gifted all the good orthopedic surgeons really jam-packed JBJS issue, I must say. Now we'll move into the headlines here. What's new and exciting in the news this week? Validation of examination maneuvers for adolescent idiopathic scoliosis in the telehealth setting. This is by Fareed and colleagues and is 30 days free. So no excuses, check it out for yourself. This is from Boston Children's Hospital. Obviously, telehealth and telemedicine have gained a lot of traction in recent years, really, really taken off and become an accepted part of practice in ways that they weren't before the COVID pandemic sort of created a situation where it was of necessity, it had to be adopted. And then once people could see what it could do, definitely became more enthusiastic for adoption. And there have been several studies or consensus groups who have talked about, you know, kind of what's appropriate for telehealth in the context of spine, one of which was Delphi panel of thought leaders assembled by the team down at HSS, Chevy Ayer, and that was published in Spine in 2022. This kind of builds off of that, although indirectly, and they're looking to validate examination maneuvers for adolescent idiopathic scoliosis in the telehealth setting. This was obviously done at Boston Children's. They had 73 patients, mean age 14.1 years. You know, I thought of this as within the context of sort of new patient presentations. I myself don't. Do you do telemedicine visits still?
I do, and I really like them. Same thing, during the pandemic, it became a necessity. And I found that patients, a lot of them, especially postoperatively, they're doing really well, prefer telemedicine visits than coming in.
Yeah. I mean, for post-op, that's one of the most ideal if they're not having a problem. Also, you know, in a follow-up to review imaging, I don't see new patients in my practice via telemedicine at all. Like, I really want to like see the patient in person and, you know, have a hands-on evaluation. Some people in their practices certainly will do telemedicine visits, you know, for the purposes of intake. And this does provide some putative evidence about making the measurements, you know, essentially having like the patients and their families use the scoliometer to make the measurement. They said that there's a learning curve as patients are educated on scoliometer use, which I thought was interesting. And that can certainly create some barriers. One of the challenges here with just 73 patients is that for very minor curves or very complex curves, which are more rare, you're probably not getting adequate variation across the full population of possible presentations of adolescent idiopathic scoliosis. You're probably getting the average patients here, which are not probably, you are definitely getting the average patients here in terms of, you know, curve magnitude. And that's going to create, you know, some distinction in terms of the measurements that you're getting, the validity and translational capacity of those measurements, and the ultimate, you know, utility. Nonetheless, I think this is, you know, good evidence that supports this use within this context, and having, you know, patients who are able to do this effectively perform these measurements in the comfort of their home. It certainly saves a trip to the office, and it makes things for a child, an adolescent, a young teen, maybe more comfortable to be seen, if only the first time, you know, in their home rather than coming into an office-based environment, which can be anxiety-inducing. So all positives here, and would have expected kind of Boston Children's to be able to have something with more than just 73 patients, though. It's just a caveat, not a real reservation. I'm not putting anything on hold. Again, if you're trying to do this with neuromuscular scoliosis patients or congenital scoliosis patients, or you know, probably cannot translate these findings to other types of scoliosis. And this is probably for the average adolescent idiopathic patient.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think it's one of those things with telemedicine, it does take a certain type of patient that feels comfortable doing these things. Sure. Not all patients are the right one. To your point about diagnoses, but even just willingness. But it is something that opens our eyes in an area that I would have never thought of doing it. And then again, I probably wouldn't have thought about doing that in hip and knee replacement patients for the longest time. So I think medicine's evolving, and so I give them credit for doing it in this patient population just to open the door. And I bet you there's more areas that this can be done in. I think children, traditionally, people always like, you know, take time off and take the kids in and have them be seen. But maybe we don't need to do that for every patient here. So interesting information, I would say.
Yeah, I think all of those are really, you know, this is particularly advantageous for those points that you brought up. But let's go into your headline, which is, this is way off base for you, corticosteroid effects on upper esophageal sphincter function in anterior cervical discectomy infusion, a study using high-resolution impedance manometry by Lai and colleagues, also permanently free. So again, no excuses, folks. Get your read on this holiday season.
It's a good way to relax. It made me relax a little bit because I'm reading about corticosteroids, whose effect is anti-inflammation. So I chose this one on purpose. I thought it was a very interesting one. Corticosteroid effects on the upper esophageal sphincter tone, because postoperative dysphagia, which is from the upper esophageal sphincter function, does happen after these ACDFs, or anterior cervical discectomy infusions. And previous studies have demonstrated that administering corticosteroids, again, which reduce inflammation, can reduce postoperative dysphagia. Most of the studies they've done really have only done patient-reported metrics, like they're able to swallow easier, or patient-reported outcomes, or other questionnaire-based metrics for improving their swallowing function, but not actually measure the physiology of it. And I liken this to, for example, total knee patients, when we would, you know, put an intramedullary canal, like we would shower the canal with microemboli, and we would say, well, there's an increased risk of clots, and there are big population database studies to show that. But someone actually held a ultrasound or echo to the heart, and you could actually see the showering of emboli, which is very interesting. So that's what I liked about this premise here. It actually quantified the upper esophageal sphincter pressure using what they called high-resolution impedance manometry, and also used a questionnaire, which is called Eating Assessment Tool 10, to determine dysphagia after ACDF when randomizing patients to receive corticosteroids locally or receive saline locally. And again, this is a local administration, not an oral or an intravenous one. Patients and analysts were blinded in the allocation process, and the treating physician was also blinded during the assessment of the swallowing. They couldn't blind the delivery of it because corticosteroids are a white creamy color while saline is a clear color, so hard to blind that there. All patients were within the 20 to 80 year old range, and they underwent ACDS, and they were excluded if they underwent revisions or operated with via anterior and posterior approaches, had trauma, infection, tumor, or other medical contraindications to local corticosteroid administration, or had coagulopathy. So a patient underwent, remember this, high-resolution impedance manometry preoperatively and at the one-year postoperative mark. And again, they were blinded to treatment allocation, and all patients were followed for 12 months after surgery, looking at postoperative complications, including complications and mortality. All these patients had a similar operative technique. There was radiographic monitoring, and they measured 11 metrics using this manometry, looking at the upper esophageal sphincter tone. They did do a sample size calculation based on one specific value, and it was this integrated relaxation pressure of looking at 20 versus 30. And they said that with a 10% dropout, they needed a total of 30 patients. They actually needed 13 patients per group, but assumed a 10% dropout rate. And they had 30 patients in the population here. There were similar patient populations, not surprisingly, given it's an RCT, and similar complications after surgery. The big finding here was 1 month postoperatively, the mean upper esophageal sphincter integrated relaxation pressure in the corticosteroid group was about 25, and it was notably reduced compared to the saline-only group, which was 33 millimeters of mercury. But remember, there were 11 measurements that were done, and out of the 11 measurements, there was only one different one, and 10 were not different. They did look at the diameter of the prevertebral soft tissue at C3 and that at C6, and it was significantly smaller in the corticosteroid group than the saline group at 1 and 3 months postoperatively. But there was no correlations between prevertebral soft tissue swelling and this upper esophageal sphincter pressure, the integrated relaxation pressure, and between prevertebral swelling and the EAT-10 questionnaire they did. And preoperative and 1 month postoperative EAT-10 scores did not significantly differ between the groups. So the authors concluded that measuring this upper esophageal sphincter pressure may be better than taking patient-reported measures, because the patient-reported measures showed no difference. The authors hypothesized that the local administration of corticosteroids, potentially the cricopharyngeal muscle, can actually help reduce inflammation of that muscle, which is a high pressure zone of the upper esophageal sphincter. And it can also reduce the pressure profile within that sphincter area. I thought it was an interesting way of adding metrics to patient reported outcomes. Again, metrics from a patient reported was a good step because it was asking the patient as opposed to asking the surgeon or the person doing the procedure. There's only short 1 month follow up. They did look at complications up to 12 months. There's only, remember, one difference in one variable. Idea of expanding the cohorts may or may not show differences, maybe different procedures. This patient population was just in Taiwan, so would there be the same findings outside of Taiwan? I don't know. Would a different method of administration make a difference? I think of this as like tranexamic acid, where you can do local, you can do topical. I said local and topical together. You can do intravenous, you can do oral. Would a combination of corticosteroids make a difference in the dysphagia risk? And then what about swallow studies at a more frequent interval, as opposed to just pre-op and 1 month post-op? What about the 1 week mark or the 2 week mark or the 3 week mark, for example? Now, I know that this is not a fun test, so it's just very hard to get people to do that multiple times. But this is good as a blinded RCT, so I give them kudos for that.
Yeah, it's a randomized trial. I think it was, you know, done well. They did have a power calculation supporting their sample. I do find it a little bit curious. You know, it's a well-powered study, well thought out. The disposition makes sense. But then they said, you know, further research is required to verify our findings, which is not really like, that shouldn't be the conclusion that you would see from a randomized trial, which is supposed to provide essentially definitive evidence. And again, it's well-powered. They did have significant finding. So I'm not sure why they're saying, again, particularly in from the standpoint that having this impedance manometry is not pleasant, I don't really know why it would need to be repeated again.
I think it's one of those knee-jerk responses, right? Like, further studies are needed.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can always call for further studies. So I like nothing with the study itself, but I think that, you know, everyone just when you're writing up research, it's so easy to be like, well, more research is necessary. And it sort of is like this monopoly get out of jail free card. Like, well, I said more studies were necessary. So I'm not, you know, like that's not when it makes sense, you should call for it. If it doesn't make sense, such as in this case, or if you cannot substantiate, well, why is more study necessary? You had like, I want to know more about that. And if it is just sort of said as a way to kind of, you know, sort of give the authors an out, that's not really the point of the science. The science should be definitive. And in this case, I would say it's a fairly definitive finding. Like everything matches up very well. It all aligns very well. So I don't understand that the call for more research or suggestion that more research is needed.
I agree. For all those listening out there, you don't have to write that every time. Promise.
Yeah. in fact, in some settings, it's better if you don't. All right. Let's move on to see if we're going to be putting cases on hold in the featurette, Demographic Disparities and Outcomes Following Hip Arthroscopy, Exploring the Impact of Social Determinants of Health in Femoral Acetabular Impingement Syndrome by Kazi and colleagues. There is an infographic. This is work that was conducted at Rush University Medical Center, looking to examine the impact of demographic disparities, largely as defined by the Social Deprivation Index. This is a way in which neighborhoods defined using zip code can be categorized in terms of the variety of factors that describe essentially the social environment. Now, the first thing is that the impact of social deprivation at the societal level and at the personal level, patient level, and the interaction between the two has been defined in a number of contexts. So we would expect that the patients that come from more disadvantaged environments and that are also more disadvantaged themselves from the standpoint of education, socioeconomic, income, associated comorbidities, and other factors that may tie in to the environment and other social determinants of health, such as, you know, tobacco use, alcoholism, drug use, et cetera, will all tie into adversely impacting outcomes. We know that from a variety of studies. Why this needs to be examined in the setting of femoroacetabular impingement? Do we expect that the outcome is going to be different? Do we expect that the findings somehow would be different because of the nature of the surgery? I expect not, and the authors don't tell us as much either. They have a lot of patients, 2,060 hips, with the following distribution across social deprivation index quartiles. 955 in the highest, 580 in the second, 281 in the third, and 244 in the fourth. So they're much heavily weighted towards higher income or less deprivation quartiles, which is, you know, for those who know Chicago and the practice of Rush, not casting aspersions, but that kind of aligns with sort of presentations or expectations along those lines. The most socially deprived groups had higher proportions of African-American and Hispanic individuals. These individuals also had less participation in physical activity, greater prevalence of smoking, low back pain, workers' compensation claims, and essentially individuals with more social deprivation demonstrated inferior outcomes. So this is aligned with the literature in the context of social deprivation. They also had, this was driven by not only the quartile of the social deprivation index from which they came, but hip pain duration, presence of joint degeneration, and overall health at presentation. Again, I feel like this is fairly well aligned, you know, with the literature. They hypothesized that patients living in areas of greater social deprivation would demonstrate poor overall health, worse clinical outcomes, and higher incidence of secondary surgery than those residing in areas of less social deprivation, which again is aligned with the context of the literature. That's what you would expect based on various copious information about the impacts of social determinants of health and the social deprivation index and how it interacts with surgical interventions writ large across the continuum of surgery, within the context of orthopedic surgery, within the context of hip surgery, be it hip replacement or hip arthroscopy or hip fractures. So again, the need for this particular work in this particular context, I'm not sure is that well substantiated. To this, I would also add, and I think this is very important, the social deprivation index is based on zip codes. And a lot of times that's not specific to the individuals. Sometimes you can have what we would call an ecological fallacy, where there can be very wealthy individuals who live in a particular area that's within the zip code in close proximity to others of more reduced financial means who are not themselves of reduced financial means. And some of that is, you know, I think reflected in these numbers here. If you look at their table one, and let's keep in mind that the average percentage of African-American patients in the, or individuals in the United States is about 13%. And for Hispanic individuals, depending on how that group is characterized, it's somewhere in like the 20 to 30% range. But across their, the top three quartiles, their numbers are 5% or less in those groups. And then when you get into the fourth quartile, which is the lowest, the most at-risk group, you still only have 12% African-American patients and 12% Hispanic patients. So in this cohort as a whole, the minority patients are underrepresented. And I think that probably speaks to issues with access and restricted access to potentially these types of services or the catchment area in which Rush University pulls from. We have said before, and I will say again, when you're studying social determinants of health, it's very hard to do that effectively within one healthcare system. And again, this is not casting aspersions or saying anything about Rush, so please don't take it that way. It's just the nature of a healthcare system is they're going to serve a certain population, and certain individuals, for one reason or another, will be able to find their way into that system. And there are other individuals that will not be able to find their way into that system. That's the way things work in almost every healthcare environment. We're no different in the Mass General Brigham system. So I'm not, again, saying anything. Someone who works at Rush, please don't take it like this is a criticism of Rush. It's just a reality. The best way to study social determinants of health is going to be across healthcare systems so that you can have a broader, wider, and more significant pool of patients such that the various interactions between social determinants of health, access, and these other factors can be addressed more successfully. So it's going to be a net, you know, even though 2,060 patients seems like very large, once you start breaking it down, it's not that many because, you know, half of those patients come from the highest income quartiles or the lowest social determinant index. And then of those, you have 90% Caucasian patients in that cohort and close to 90% in the second quartile as well. So I do think that there's restricted sociodemographic variation in this cohort. And I think I've illustrated that amply. I don't have a problem with their findings. Their findings, again, are what you would expect. I'm just not sure what the, you know, what would be considered novel or paradigm changing in this context. I don't know if you had a different take on it.
No, and this is those things that it's interesting information, but I think I've definitely seen this before where, you know, I read something in total joints and I see it come up again in the sports literature in a different procedure and, you know, in the spine literature. It's, and we all do this. And so it's interesting information, but I don't think it's necessarily earth shattering.
Yeah, I mean, it's what you would expect knowing what we know in these times about social deprivation index and the sociodemographic and clinical characteristics that have a negative prognostic outlook for outcomes following whatever type of surgery or orthopedic surgery or hip surgery. The question is, and this is, it's a hypothetical because it hasn't been answered, but it certainly isn't answered by this paper either, is what do we do to make this better?
Mm-hmm. And it's not at the point that we can actually do something about it. It's that this is just building awareness again.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to move into our honorable mentions at this point. We have sagittal fragment rotation and Ogden type 1 classifications. Our hallmarks of combined tibial tubercle fracture and patellar tendon injury by Schultz and colleagues. This is a retrospective review of patients presenting to a single tertiary children's hospital with tibial tubercle fractures between 2012 and 2023. They identified 262 fractures in 252 patients. They used a multivariable analysis to demonstrate fragment rotation on lateral radiographs and Ogden type 1 classifications were the most predictive risk factors for a combined injury. And they found the Ogden classification fragment rotation not only the most useful, but also helpful in distinguishing between isolated fractures and those fractures that are combined with patellar tendon injury. They maintain it's the first study to identify risk factors in this setting, and that they feel it is informative and can aid in preoperative planning. We then have minimally invasive surgery for posterior atlantoaxial lateral mass joint fusion, a muscle-sparing procedure for atlantoaxial instability or dislocation by Hung and colleagues. This is a clinical retrospective on the author's experience at Peking University, or really Beijing University, Third Hospital's Department of Orthopedics from January 2021 to December 2021. Compared to a historical control group of patients treated using the Goll-Harms technique. This was a prospective cohort study per the authors using minimally invasive procedures for atlantoaxial fusion. And they maintained that this was superior in terms of postoperative pain, length of hospital stay, both of which directly affect patient satisfaction and postoperative recovery. So those who may be interested in using these types of techniques or adapting them to their practice, you should definitely check that out. This is graded as level 2 evidence. We then have high-dose TXA is associated with less blood loss than low-dose TXA without increased complications in patients with complex adult spinal deformity by Kim and colleagues. This is a multi-center data set retrospectively analyzed in which they identified 265 patients separated into three groups by a TXA regimen. And they found that patients with deformity who received high-dose intraoperative TXA had fewer transfusions intraoperatively, fewer transfusions perioperatively, and less blood loss than those who received lower medium doses. No difference in the rates of seizure or thromboembolic complications. Of course, in a lot of these studies, just you know, as a caveat, those events that are you know fairly rare, they're oftentimes underpowered to identify those significant differences. But that aside, that rounds it out for this first issue in the month of December. Hope everyone is getting into the holiday spirit. We'll wish everyone a real happy holidays in our second episode. We're about out of time at this point. If you liked what you heard, come in for December part 2, where Dr. Chen will be leading us and bringing us into the new year. If you didn't like what you heard, thank you for listening to us for this long. We'll consider it a holiday gift to us, but hopefully you enjoyed. Hit the notification bell, follow us, give us a 5-star rating if you can. Find us on Stitcher, Castos, Amazon, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast, the JBJS website. And that's it. We're about out of time. Hopefully your cases are ready to go, but here, even though it's the holiday season and we're in the holiday spirit, your case is still on hold.